Hey, welcome to Growing a Fruitful Brand, where we discuss how to create and grow a brand that makes the world a better place for you, your customers, and your employees. I'm Ben Luters, founder and art director of Fruitful Design and Strategy, and this is my business partner and brand strategist, Raj Lula. This is a very special episode. It's actually part one of two parts where we talk about Raj's upcoming book, The Caring House. And in the second part, we're going to get more into his personal brand and kind of the process behind that. Raj, are you ready for this?
Sure.
I feel like self-promotion is like the hardest thing for marketers and branders to do. How has that been?
Awful. It's been really stretching. I'm an introvert by nature, and so putting myself out there, you know, I think part of the reason I wrote a book was because it was me by myself for a very long time sharing my thoughts with the world, and it would be so nice if I could just rely on a publishing company or something to put the book out there and then do all the marketing and not have to do anything, which of course is not reality, because even famous authors, Stephen King or whoever, have to go on, you know, talk shows or whatever to promote their book,
right?
Because that's how books get sold. But I don't think I anticipated this part of it when I decided to write a book.
So before we go any further, can you just give our listeners who don't know, what is The Caring House about in a nutshell?
Yeah. So for those who are on video, here's a the
there
cover.
It is.
Yeah, The Caring House.
Nice cover, Raj.
So The Caring House.
Where did you get that artwork? Is that
it was designed
AI
by
art or Fiverr?
Amazingly talented designer.
Thank you.
The Caring House is a novel. So even though this is, you know, our Growing a Fruitful Brand podcast, I'm not talking about a business book or a marketing book here. It's a novel. It's a fiction book. And it was inspired by a grief support center for children in Salt Lake City, where unfortunately about 60% of the kids have lost their father. And I was listening to an episode of This American Life one day as I was driving to Fruitful, actually. And I just was kind of struck by this idea. What if a little boy and a little girl met at a place like this, each of them having lost a dad? And unfortunately, a high percentage of those kids have lost their father to suicide. And so, you know, what if two kids met having lost their fathers both in that same way? They grow up, they fall in love and get married, stayed connected through their youth, and they get married. And you know, with as difficult as marriage is, could two people survive the suspicion that every day might be their last with each other? That they might just have kind of tragedy written into their DNA and their family history. And the book is, I know it sounds like a heavy topic, but it's full of humor and it's hopeful. And so I really hope that it means a lot to the people who read it.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, like Raj just said, it definitely is a heavy topic, but at the same time, you know, Raj brings a lot of, you know, the humor, you know, for those of you who listen to us or watch us, you know, Raj has a great sense of humor, a sense of just warmth and joy. And it definitely comes through in the book. I read a very early version of it. I was just telling Roz the other day, you know, he has gone through a lot of editing and a lot of things. And I actually haven't read the most recent, so I will read it once I finally get the hard copy in my hand next month. But I'm excited for people to get their hands on it. One of the questions that immediately might come to people's minds who know you as a successful, you know, business owner, brand strategist, and brand thinker is, you're a busy guy. How did you find the time to write this book? I mean, this isn't like, you know, a 20-page business ebook or something like that. This is a legitimate novel, hundreds of pages long. You know, then it's gone through many revisions and editing processes. How did you make the time to write this book?
Yeah, there's a few answers to that question. in some ways, I don't really feel like I did find the time. And what I mean by that is, you know, it sort of feels like a lot of things about this book, the story found me, the time found me, or the time was sort of forced on me. And what I mean by that is I lost two friends the year that I started writing this book, right before I started writing this book. Both of them were in their 30s. Both of them had kids. I was especially close with one of them. And so I don't think I realized how much that was kind of writing in the background with me as I was writing this book, that I was actually kind of writing just kind of this book about, like, how is anybody okay? Like, this, you know, one of my friends, Heather, she went to sleep one night, you know, three kids just didn't wake up in the morning. And it was devastating for their family. And, you know, our marriage for Lindsay and I, it started with a somewhat similar tragedy where her sister, Lindsay's little sister, died the year that we got married. She was 22. She had a 3-year-old that she left behind. And so kind of that whole time, you know, the first 10 years of our marriage was just filled with these moments of grief and loss. And so part of me feels like I had to make the time. It was one of my ways of dealing with these things that were going on in my life. I don't think I really realized that when I was writing it. When I was writing it, I felt like I heard this really interesting idea on This American Life, and then I just had to start writing, and it felt kind of more like a creative impulse than an emotional or mental impulse. And you know, so that's kind of one answer, is like it really feels like the story found me. It feels like the time found me. The more practical answer is that for one, I have an amazing wife who's very understanding, and there were times where it kind of felt like the characters were living like in an apartment above my head. You know, it was like felt like I could hear them talking, sort of. And in fact, that's why I started writing, is you know, the place that this book is based on has a kind of a particular way of helping kids understand it at an age appropriate level how their person died, because they want them to know that it's final, and that, that, you know, we're not going to use cliches like, oh, you know, they went to sleep forever or whatever, that kind of, they want them to really understand what's happening so they can grieve it. And in the This American Life episode, they have a kid kind of describing, that his dad had died by suicide, and the most kind of, you know, 7-8-year-old way that he could articulate this was, my dad shot his brains. And I know it's really heavy, and I apologize to anybody who's, you know, had experience with these things, but just thinking through that, thinking about a married couple, and, you know, at what point would a husband or a wife ever bring up that's the way that you met? You know, it's like, what conflict happened? What offense happened in their marriage that you have to drag that thing out of the closet? Because it's not every day, I would imagine. Like, I can't imagine that you'd be talking about that on a regular basis. And so it's like, that's the one card that you never play, except for when things are really, really serious. And so it's almost like I started hearing this conversation before I even started writing. And sometimes it felt like, I have to get this down on paper so these people will stop talking in my head. I'm not going crazy or anything. Don't worry about it. But
he's hearing voices.
I've heard I've heard a lot of writers describe this kind of process. If you've ever seen The Man Who Invented Christmas, about Charles Dickens writing the Christmas Carol, he had kind of a similar, you know, they used kind of a similar theme in that movie where it's like Scrooge and Bob Cratchit and all those folks were actually talking to him, telling him what to do in the story. On a more practical level, like I said, Lindsay allowed me a lot of Sundays in coffee shops to write it, but I'd say about 50% of this book was written between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. You know, put the kids down to bed, watch a show with Lindsay, she goes to bed, I start writing. And that was not particularly healthy, but there's kind of an obsessiveness to writing. You know, it's like Donald Miller talked about how it's, you know, writing is like you should treat your writing like a professional athlete treats their sport. And, you know, nobody gets on the case of an athlete who gets up at 5 a.m. and goes to the gym. Well, in the same way, you know, sometimes writers got to write between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m.
Got to make the time for it. I'm curious, you know, Raj knows this, but I've also started getting into some fiction writing in the last few years. And I'm curious, for you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, hopefully we'll be doing a similar episode like this in a little while from my own book. But, you know, there's different ways of writing fiction. And I'm curious for you, you know, it sounds to me like it was a more of an organic process where it kind of started with this question, you know, which is a very brand strategist way to start a book, I think, too, where you have this like compelling, you know, question or scenario and wanting to kind of flesh that out and like how would that happen? When would they say this? How would this go? How would this end? You know, this kind of question. Did you, in your process, did you feel like you had to heavily, you know, storyboard things out or, you know, plan things out? Did you have this master plan where you knew exactly where it was going to go and the thing that you were hearing, the dialogue, was just kind of filling in those scenes? Or were you kind of like learning where this was going along the way?
A little bit of both. So there's kind of two major approaches in writing. One of them they call pantser, which is, it's like writing by the seat of your pants, essentially, that you don't really know where things are going and you're just kind of discovering the characters and stuff as they go. The other one's called the plotter. Mm-hmm. And then of course, because writers are writers, there's a middle ground where they'll call it like a plantser or a plotser, which is sort of a mix of the two. I would say I was probably a mix of the two. Because I did start with this really big what if, you know, what if these two kids met in grief counseling, you know, could they grow up and fall in love and get married and stay married without becoming their parents, without repeating tragedy? And so I that started out kind of more of a pantser approach of just going, I need to uncover this. And like I said, now I kind of realize more I was uncovering this for myself as much as for the story. But then there were some very, very methodical, strategic things that did help write the book. One of those is there was a podcast called Story Grid. And anybody who's writing fiction, I highly, highly recommend that podcast and the book. Sean Coyne used to be an editor in one of the major publishing houses. And, you know, one of his frustrations was that editors will give really unhelpful feedback, like, man, it's just not working for me, which is a very subjective thing to say. It's very emotional and it's not very, you know, constructive. And so Sean, in his craft as an editor, really wanted to figure out why don't some stories work and why do other stories work? And what he found is that there are these things called conventions in each genre and obligatory scenes that serve those conventions. That's all a lot of kind of literary mumbo jumbo for the idea that if you're going to have a love story, for example, you have to have the meet cute, which is where they have a run in with each other, or they, you know, they have to meet in some way that's interesting. And you have to kind of leave the audience going, oh, I think they're going to get together. And then you also have to have, you know, what they call the consummation of love scene. That's not as gross as it sounds. Like, a kiss can be a consummation of love, but they can't end the movie with crossing their arms at each other and going, maybe we will. They have to actually...
At least a fist bump is required. Yeah. I think that's the new Disney movies. That's what you get. Yeah.
A little nod. You know, there were some very strategic things like that. I took Aaron Sorkin's masterclass on masterclass.com about writing screenplays. And, you know, it was great because he gave a really, really simple formula for writing stories, which was, it's Aristotle's formula, where you take a character, you run them up a tree, you throw rocks at them, and you let them back down again. And I know that sounds like really, really simple, but really what it's describing is an inciting incident, something that happens at the beginning that makes this character and kind of running for their life or whatever. And then you have escalating conflict. You're throwing rocks at them. And then you have resolution, whether it's a tragic resolution or a positive resolution. You still have to let them down from the tree, because people aren't, you know, it's like in a spy movie, if somebody's hiding out, you know, halfway through the movie, and then they're still hiding at the end of the movie, you're going to go, what the heck? Why did I just pay $10 to go see this? There's no end to this movie. So, you know, there's those things that had to happen. What's interesting is that I, about halfway through the book, I became a plotter, because you start, you know, with kind of all these little seeds of ideas that kind of grow up through the middle of the book, and then you have to bring them all home. And that's hard. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about 86,000 words. Like, the average novel is 80 to 100,000 words. This one's about 86,000. And so, like, that's way more than you can really get your head around and like memorize. If you, I'm trying to think, like, if you were trying to tell the entire story of Pride and Prejudice from the beginning, you know, could you do it? Most of us couldn't. And even if we could, it was because we saw the hour and a half movie version of it, not because we had all 86,000 or how many ever words are in that book.
Maybe
you,
more.
You know, floating around in our head. And so some of the ways that Jane Austen brings that story back together, so masterful. And, you know, obviously she's one of the literary greats in doing that. And so I took over a wall in my basement and just started taping up note cards. And I go, here are the scenes that I have. And I knew the end of the book. And I go, okay, what has to happen between here and there? And truthfully, that only got me to about 50,000 words. And then I hired a developmental editor from StoryGrid and had them help me figure out what scenes were missing from there to the end.
No, that's really helpful. And I think that is, as I've listened to other people talk about their work, I think you described a way of writing that is common, where you have this general idea of a thing. You have to kind of get into the characters, into the story a little bit. And then you do get to a point where you kind of know where you want it to go. And then, or where it needs to go. And then it's like, okay, how are we going to get there? That is very similar to my own process in my own book. It was like, I was having a problem. Like, I had no problem starting. And then it was hard for me to just do the hard work of just getting into the story, getting into the characters, because I wasn't sure exactly where it was going to go. So once I made that decision, it was like, okay, we need to have some kind of a, you know, plotter system here to get there. And then it was like, it was like clockwork at that point. And so I'm really curious, Raj, like, you know, you already said it. This is a lot of words, right? This is a lot of time. How long did it take you? Like, how long ago did you start this process?
Yes, I started writing the book 8 years ago. And
wow.
So it's funny, because when you, in the intro, when you're talking about, you know, Raj just wrote a book, it's like, well, sort of, you know, I started 8 years ago. The first draft was finished about 5 years ago, I think. And that was kind of difficult, because I mean, first time I'd ever written a book, I knew I was at 50 to 55,000 words at that point, and I didn't know what was missing. And it was actually through a StoryBrand, through a StoryBrand workshop that I was attending, where, you know, Don hammers home this idea of, like, you need a guide. That's what we talk about so much in StoryBrand. And it's like, well, if I'm the hero of writing this book, I need a guide. And that's when I decided to reach out to StoryGrid.
Take your own medicine a little bit there.
Yeah. And found a great, editor. Her name is Sheila. And, what was great is that she just started asking questions about the book. Oh, what happened with this character? Who is this? What? Why did this happen? And as she would ask those questions, I would know the answers intrinsically. Like, I would just go, oh, well, that's because when they were kids, blah, blah, blah. And she would just go, it's not on the page. Write it. And so every week I'd have an assignment. And so in about 3 months during 2020, I wrote a 30,000 words. So it took me, you know, about 3 years to write the first 50,000. And then in about 3 months at the end of 2020, I wrote the last 30,000 of the book. And that's, I mean, that's the power of what a guide can do for you. But so I would say the book has officially been kind of finished, quote unquote, for about, you know, 3 or 4 years now. There has been some revision since then, but it's been largely the same story since that time.
I love how most of our audience has probably been like, wait, why are they talking about this novel? And then now it's come back around to what we do every day, which is get a guide and the power of story and storytelling, you know? And I love the humility. Like that would, that I was like surprised in a way, not that you were able to humble yourself to like ask someone else to help you, but like, I think of you as an expert storyteller guide yourself. And I love that, you know, when you found yourself in this new territory, though, you realize, hey, I need to find someone who's done this before. I need someone who's gone before me. Like you were in, even though, you know, you've done millions of brand scripts and you have an amazing grasp of the power of story and you are a guide to so many with their brands. When you're in this new territory, you immediately felt the conviction of, hey, I need to do what I'm always asking my clients to do, and that is find the guide.
I mean, it took me 3 years to have that conviction immediately, but yes.
But you came around.
I sat down with, so we had an intern this summer. His name is Sam Carter. He's actually a longtime family friend. And he's studying English at Cal Baptist University. So while he was here this summer, we actually started outlining one of my next books. And that was a really great experience because I had a lot of answers before I even started writing on this book. And so it was like to get ahead of that process and take more of a plotter approach to it, that has been really, really helpful working on the next book. Now, it is interesting, though, because that does change the workflow a little bit. It changes the motivation. Like with the Caring House, there was definitely more of a sense that I was discovering these people, felt like they were bugging me all the time. And with, this other book, it feels a little bit more like work, you know, because it's like, oh, I have a road that I have to travel and I have to hit these stops along the way. And so I will definitely get to the point where it's emotionally as invested, but it's just going to be a different approach because the road's already laid out for me.
So I'm curious, Raj, you know, obviously this is a lot of work, writing a novel, a labor of love, but what was the most fun part of it for you? The most fun and rewarding part?
You know, I think I'm just now getting to the most fun part.
Plot twist.
I spent 8 years more or less doing this by myself. I have had a couple of really great editors, and I've had a couple of friends who have read earlier versions of the book to make sure that I'm not going to make an absolute fool out of myself. But now that people who were not invested in the creation of this book are reading it, I'm getting some really fun text messages from friends, that are showing their perspectives on it. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote about grief was because it is a universal human experience. Like, I saw a child psychologist even talking about how there are moments of grief, even in joyous things, like when your kid learns to walk or crawl. Well, it's obviously a very celebratory thing. You want your kids to hit developmental milestones, all those things. There's also an element of grief for even the child where they are not going to be held closely to you forever. And whether or not they even understand that they're processing some grief, you know, it's funny that we see these developmental milestones in kids, and we also see these kind of independent streak behaviors that we all kind of grit our teeth through. And it's like, yeah, it's a willful 2-year-old or whatever. But a little bit of what we don't understand is that there's an amount of grief for the kids when they go through these milestones, because they both want to be independent and they want to be close to you. And so even if you've never really lost somebody that is close to you, we all experience these micro moments of grief really frequently. And then, if you live long enough, which most people do, you will lose someone that matters to you. And in a weird way, it's like, I sort of hope that you do, because if you don't, then you're the one that somebody else lost. And so it's better to be the one
that's
who,
what I was just thinking.
Yeah. Has lost than the one who is lost to someone else. So I wrote about grief because it's such a universal human experience. It was something that we experienced acutely in our lives. I talked about losing my sister-in-law. We lost a couple of pregnancies. Then I lost some friends, lost jobs, all sorts of things in that like first 10 years of our marriage. And I wanted to write a book that was just like, can anybody be okay? How do we all make it through this life, knowing that I wouldn't even say unscathed, you know, because it's like, no, you will be definitely right. Scathed. Like, how do you make scathed. It through anyway? How do you redeem those scars? And so now the fun part is getting to see people bring their own things into the story. I had a friend who texted me and said that one of the relationships in the book reminded her of a thing that hit a little too close to home. And she even texted, she goes, I'm scared to keep reading, but
wow.
She's like, but I know it's going to a good place. And it's like those things, getting to see this mean something to other people, knowing that 8 years wasn't spent in vain. It's so hard to measure success in something like this. You obviously have the New York Times bestsellers list. You have, you know, being traditionally published, you have money, all sales numbers, all those things. But, I'm now able to say that my primary metric of success is how much does this book mean to people? And it's already meant a lot to a few people, and that's going to be enough. I hope that I don't have a, you know, basement full of book boxes, but I would like to sell all the copies, but it meaning anything to anyone is now enough to have that kind of, to have that kind of impact is, it was kind of unexpected, to be honest. I wrote it because I needed to write it, and now for it to be helpful mm-hmm. to other people is the most important thing.
That's super cool to hear, Raj, because yeah, like when you're writing a project, it's a very personal thing, you know, and even if you think, first of all, we're creatives, we tend to be plagued with self-doubt and imposter syndrome anyways, right? And so, you know, even if there's like a little bit of us that's like, hey, I think this is pretty good. It can be so scary to put that out in public, no matter what it is. So when you see the response that it's having, and it's such a positive one, I can see why that would be just so fulfilling. And I'm curious, Raj, you already kind of mentioned, you know, with our intern Sammy, that you've started outlining and working on at more stories. And I'm just curious, like, do you have some other things in the works? Is this like just the first of many? Is this Raj the author now, or what can we expect in years to come?
So a couple of years ago, I was on the Business Made Simple podcast with Donald Miller, and he was talking about my author brand. And we actually ended up using some of those quotes on the book cover and on my website, my new website that you designed for me. Thank you very much. It's very great.
Thanks for the plug.
And he said essentially that I'm the kind of author who can wrestle with the idea, with the hope that life is worth living. So my other books are not going to be as, you know, starting with death as this book is. They are books that really kind of wrestle with some of the bigger themes that we all struggle with. One of them is about, you know, dealing with, you know, growing up as the child of an immigrant. One of them is about, our relationships with our bodies and body image. And then another that's in the very early stages is about our relationship with faith and religion. And I hope that they all make it to, you know, to the same point here. But I feel strongly about each of these ideas. And as I can grab my you know, either 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. or Sunday coffee times or whatever. I definitely want to put more work out into the world. I would love to see, kind of a little community grown around these books, and a similar way to how, you know, John Green and Hank Green have their Nerd Fighter, community of people who, you kind of wear their heart on their sleeve a little bit and aren't as concerned with being stoic and jaded and want to say, hey, yeah, this, I've got a big heart and I'm feeling my way through this world and it's a lot. And it's nice to know there's other people out there who are feeling the same. And so that's where I hope to go in the next several years here as a writer. Would love to see, you know, one or more of these adapted into a screenplay as well and see if we can't make some noise with something like that.
Being a business leader, or just, you know, someone who, you know, is known for their work, that finds like a passion on the side, that has a creative passion outside of their 9-to-5. So I'm curious, Raj, what practical advice would you have for, you know, those out there who have, you know, a creative passion on the side, but are maybe just afraid to invest in it, investing time, money, or especially just putting it out there for others to see? What practical advice would you give someone to kind of get out of that mindset?
I would say that we spend our money on a lot dumber things. It would probably be my first answer. If you really think about it, if you think about the amount of joy that your Netflix subscription or a slightly newer Honda or, you know, any of those things will actually bring to your life, very few of those things will bring you as much joy as learning, refining, honing a craft that you care about. And, I've had several friends say, you know, wow, no matter what happens with this book, your kids are going to have a book that their dad wrote. And I honestly didn't really like that at first because, for one, I wanted it to be more successful than that. But the other thing was that, like, this book is not going to be appropriate for my kids to read for some time. It's got some pretty, like, adult, you know, themes in it. And not adult content, but adult themes. And so it's like, yeah, okay, you know, hopefully that will mean something to them at some point. Now I'm starting to understand that a little bit better, especially, you know, I just lost my grandma in December, and, you know, everything that she has left behind is now a memorial to her. And, you know, she, especially later in life, really loved cardinals, like the birds. And and somebody mentioned that after, after seeing her, or after, you know, she passed, like, they've been seeing them everywhere. And I feel like I have been too. Now, part of that's the Mandela effect or Mandala effect, we just feel like things pop up everywhere, but it's still a nice comfort. It's a nice thing to go, even if this is the Mandela effect, I'm still okay with going, yeah, but it's a nice reminder of somebody who cared about me in my life. And so for the book to be out there, you know, for my kids eventually, and then also that they knew that their dad had what it took to craft a whole world, you know, to pull 86,000 words together, which, if you think about it, is the 26 letters of the alphabet rearranged 86,000 times, you know, into words that then have made people cry, that have made people dig up things that they hadn't dealt with and are starting to deal with, that have given people hope about tough situations in their lives. That is starting to become really meaningful. And so anybody who's thinking about a side project, it doesn't need to be as, deep and intense as a book about grief. If it's, you know, like our friend Mark Anderson, who's a pastor here in town, is an amazing artist. And it's not a part of his day job, for the most part, but I love seeing his work. It's, I mean, you know, as little of it that I actually get to see, but he does that. He does woodworking. He's actually really amazing at designing landscapes as well, like actual like landscaping. And he just makes the world more beautiful around him. And that has a ton of value. Who cares if it has economic return? You know, don't put yourself in a hole too deeply for these things. Do only what you can with you know, living within your means. But if it's the difference between you spending, you know, money on a case of beer each month or you know, pies or whatever your thing is that you want to consume, and instead you go, hey, you know what, I'm going to put my pie budget towards writing a book or to buy
there goes the pie budget. It's always the first to go.
I mean, maybe not the whole pie budget, but but yeah, whatever it
just
is,
a fraction of the pie budget.
If you have any margin in your life whatsoever, you're never going to regret learning how to do a new thing. It's going to make you stronger and more creative and more tenacious in every area of your life.
Well, friends, this book comes out on Raj's 40th birthday. I think I can say that on the podcast. Next month, March 26th is when this officially comes out. But you can actually pre-order it now. And Raj is doing a really cool thing with the pre-orders. Raj, you want to kind of unpack that for our listeners and then also tell them, where do they go to buy this thing?
Yeah. So I'll start with that answer. You can go to rajlula.com/book. So just my name .com/book. It's also available on Amazon if you want to search it. It's called The Caring House, or you can search my name. But so with all the pre-orders, I am donating all of the royalties, every dollar of the royalties, to the grief counseling or grief support center for children that inspired the book. It's called The Sharing Place. It's a great place in Salt Lake City. And so there's a couple of reasons that I've done this. One is I would much rather rely on word of mouth, on organic reach to sell this book than to pay Zuckerberg or whoever. The other reason I wanted to do that is years ago, you and I had a conversation. I don't know if you even remember this, but we had a conversation that I said I wanted to grow a $1 million business. And that I
remember this.
And that I wanted to donate $10,000 by my 40th birthday. I think it was probably 33 at the time. And 40 felt a very long way away. It feels much closer now.
It goes by very fast.
Yeah. And we've certainly donated well over $10,000 in the aggregate over that time. But I would love to write one $10,000 check to this place by my 40th birthday. And there's also a very, thank you. There's also a very practical reason, for doing this. So, cause I just want to let people in, since we're a marketing podcast, let people in on the brand strategy of this a little bit. So, there's this kind of rule on Amazon that among indie authors, that if you can sell about 1,000 books, then Amazon will start to recommend your book with other people. Like, you know, so people who like John Green's books might also like my books. And so the Amazon algorithm will start to pick those things up if you sell about 1,000 books. Well, about 1,000 books would be about a $10,000 donation. And so instead of pumping, you know, Jeff Bezos' pocket full of cash and doing ads on Amazon, I want to get people rallied around the Sharing Place and, you know, support these kids. 60% of these kids have lost a father. And all of the kids have lost a loved one. And I'd much rather us just spread the word about that and go, hey, even if you think that this book is stupid, you know, it's like, well, who cares? I mean, I really hope you love it. But even if you don't like it, if you hate it in the first 5 pages, hey, you made a donation to kids who have lost a loved one. And they unfortunately have to grow so fast. There's always a waiting list. There's always kids driving from sometimes as far as 100 miles away to get the help that this center brings. And I just want to like make everything about that. And so it was a very strategic and a very idealistic decision to do it this way. I'm spending $0 on ads for this book. And so everything that I do is just relying on the goodwill of people to go, hey, you know what? Either they believe in me or they want to support these kids enough that it's worth buying a copy of this book. And if we're successful in the whole thing, then it's going to be, I hope, a case study in essentially cause marketing or social marketing that points a path for other people. Anything that you can align your work with and use that instead of, you know, just making billionaires even richer, I think it's a really cool thing. And that's why I decided to market this book this way. It's both what's best for the book and what's best for the world. And I want to see if we can get it done.
That's a win-win right there. And of course, Raj Lula would have the most ingenious way of marketing his own book. I hope that's helpful for some people who are in a similar spot.
Yeah.
That's right. We'll see where that goes.
Ben, one thing I'd love to kind of talk about, because we get a lot of business owners, a lot of our clients, they want to write a book. And they don't necessarily want to write a fiction book, especially not the kind of fiction book I wrote, but they want to write a book. And I get asked about this a lot. One thing that I would advise to other writers is, or to anybody who wants to become a writer.
Yeah.
Especially if you're writing nonfiction. This is very story brand, but think about what problem your book is going to solve for the audience. A lot of people start writing, especially a nonfiction book, kind of more of a memoir. And they go, well, this is just my story. This is the story of how I succeeded in business or whatever. And that's totally fine. However, you don't need to include every single anecdote of your journey to being successful as a business leader. You have to know why you're writing the anecdotes that you are. For most of us, we're not Phil Knight, who wrote Shoe Dog. Most of us are not, any of the Elon Musks or Steve Jobs of the world, that people are just going to be interested in our biographies. most of us are not going to be the people who other people are just inherently interested in our biography. And so then we go, okay, why am I writing these stories to someone? And what that'll do for you is that it usually will help you realize that you have actually more than one book in you if you want there to be. Because you might be writing about empowering women, other women in the workforce, because you know how hard it's been to come up in the workforce as a woman. I've got a couple people in my life who that kind of topic would apply to. One would be about using emotional intelligence in the workplace. One would be about how to fund a business or how to grow a business without ever taking on debt. You know, those could be great topics as well. And so deciding why you're writing the book that you're writing, and again, this definitely switches far over into the especially nonfiction world. With a fiction book, you kind of have to discover what the book is for, who the book is for after you've written it. With a nonfiction book, you should know before you write it why you're writing it. And if you've already written, either blog posts or little snippets that you go, oh, I guess this doesn't really fit this book, that's great. Put them in a folder, save it for the second or third or fourth book, because that will be really helpful to you in the future. I hope that you have multiple books in you. That will make it so much easier. And to be honest, you can even follow a fairly similar structure to that thing that I talked about from Aaron Sorkin. So talk about a time that you experienced a problem. So you were run up a tree, all the complications you experienced, so you got rocks thrown at you, and then you were let back down again, how you eventually got to success. Problem and solution. And then the stuff in the middle is going to show empathy and authority for your solution. These are all parts of the story brand framework. You could definitely story brand your book. You can ask us, or you can go to mybrandscript.com, and every book should have those elements. If not, then we're honestly kind of writing for vanity. We're writing because do we just want to be seen and validated and all those things? And that's understandable. But you can both want to be validated and write a book that's really useful and really helpful to other people.
Yeah. Otherwise, just write a journal.
Yeah.
Like if it's just for yourself and your own. Yeah, exactly. Or don't let your kids find it, depending on what you write.
Eventually.
Eventually. Put a lock on that diary. I think that's a good point. And I think another one that I would say just to throw out there as kind of a beginning author myself, is like, just find time to write, like make time to write like anything. You know, one of the things I've found inspiring, Raj, as you started promoting your book is, and really actually as you've been doing this 365 Instagram photo a day challenge, the photos are great, Raj. The captions are maybe even better, you know, like you're writing so much in some of these captions, and it's, if I miss a day or two, now I've got all this to read. It's like, I've got all this new reading material. And I have not caught up on everything that you've posted, but I love that you as a writer are finding opportunities every day, to write and to flex that muscle and to think, you know, it's not just, you know, if you look at Raj's Instagram, and I encourage you to check out Raj's Instagram if you don't already follow him, you know, he doesn't just have like, here's a picture of me, you know, giving a speech and the number of what day it is. He doesn't have just like, here's a picture of a leaf and water droplets on it or something, you know, like he has these really, really thoughtful, little mini, writing projects, most days that, really make you think about things. It's very on brand for Raj. And I know that it's like helping to scratch that itch, of being a writer, which Raj, he finds ways of scratching that in lots of different places, including with our clients. But, I love seeing that. And I think that's a really good, you know, way of, you know, whether it's a blog, whether it's like a daily social media kind of a practice. There's lots of different ways to kind of work writing in. And it can also be personal, like I mentioned and joked about, you know, with a daily journal. I've been journaling since before I could write, actually. I started dictating to my mom to write my journal. I have some of those early ones. But I've had like a pretty consistent practice of journaling. And that's been a way for me to just kind of, even if it's not being shared publicly, you know, that's a good way to just personally practice just formulating thoughts and words and ideas. But then I think taking that other step, like Raj mentioned, his favorite part of writing has actually been seeing how it's affected others. And I think there's something to be said about not hiding that light under a bushel basket, you know, of like, there's something that happens when, you know, you get this out of your personal like journal and see how it might affect others, how it might touch others. And that can be really hard, but I would encourage you to try it, maybe even in small ways. How can you, and not just to promote yourself or to make yourself feel good, but like Raj is saying, what are problems that you could be helping other people with? What are problems that other people have that, you know, maybe your story, or you have a unique perspective, you know, really, again, to bring it back to StoryBrand, how can you guide other heroes on their journey? Raj has found all kinds of really clever ways of doing that kind of in his own personal brand and profile on Instagram. And yeah, I just encourage people to find ways of doing that. And I'm sure Raj, you would agree, like it's not about the likes. It's not about the numbers and the follows. That's all fun. And obviously everyone wants to, you know, reach as many people as possible especially if they have a really, you know, compelling message and they really, you know, have a heart for helping others. So there's nothing wrong with that stuff. But I think if that's the only reason you're doing it, you're going to fall flat, you know, really focus on what you're writing. And, you know, hopefully that stuff will follow, but even if it doesn't, I would just challenge, you know, those listening that let that be enough. You know, I love how you know, when you ask Raj about his book, he immediately is like, you know, even if it's just my kids that get this someday, that's going to be enough, in a way. You know, obviously we all wish for more, but like, you know, not to set your bar low, but like be content, be satisfied with this much, so that if it turns into this, obviously that'll be great, but you're not going to be filled with disappointment, et cetera, if you don't hit this certain metric.
Well, I think that for me, the idea of becoming a New York Times bestseller or, you know, selling the movie rights to Apple or whoever is part of what motivated me to go through the process of growing to to get to the point where I am okay with those other metrics. And so I don't, right. you know, there's no problem with wanting to make the best thing ever and wanting to have it do really, really well. But, you know, it's been really helpful to me. One of the reasons I chose to self-publish was because I heard something, I wish I could remember who said it, but they were saying that both the book industry and the movie industry don't actually know how to make a hit. Like, as much as you would think that Hollywood has the formula for a hit, and of course there are certain things that help, like star power and, you know, story and, you know, superheroes that we're familiar with or whatever. But how many superhero movies have flopped? You know, like how many big budget yeah. superhero movies do we just yawn at and go, it's just another one of those, you know? Even like, you know, massive franchises like Transformers fell off after a while, you know, and yeah. you can argue whether or not those were ever good to start with, but I mean, they obviously hit something at the beginning, but then people just stopped paying attention for the most part, and they've kind of had to reboot the franchise a couple of times now. So part of the reason I self-published was because if they're not any better at picking the hits than the average person, then why let them have all the rights to your work without a guarantee that it's actually going to do any better that way? Again, that's why I'd rather partner with a nonprofit that is going to be affected by this, going to be impacted by this, than to just waste some of the results of this on hoping that a publishing house actually knows what they're doing better than I do. So have that ambition. Like, it's great. Have that ambition, but also know that, you know, some of the greatest writers, some of the greatest musicians were never appreciated in their lifetime. You know, we tell these stories about Van Gogh or about Mozart or about, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald before The Great Gatsby blew up during World War II. You know, all of those things. We tell those stories, but then we don't actually think about them as ourselves. You know, we think of it's like, well, yeah, I was
we all Stephen want to experience that success in our life. Yeah,
exactly. Stephen King got rejected 60 times, but then he hit it big, and it's like, yeah, but that's not guaranteed. We like those stories yeah. because they're the exceptions. You know, how many people tried to build Apple before Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak ran into each other? And part of the reason that those guys even ran into each other was because Steve Jobs had such poor hygiene, because he thought that eating a fruitarian lifestyle would keep him from having BO, and he was wrong, that he had to work the night shift.
Different kind of fruitful.
He had to work the night shift, and that's where he met Steve Wozniak. And, you know, it's like, or I think that's where he met Steve. But either way, you know, there were these things that happened in their lives that... you know, that just are, you can't replicate them. And, yeah. So to do the thing, be ambitious, be really excited about it, and know that along the way, you're going to figure out why you're really doing it. And that's a great, great process to go through. It's good for you. This book has been like therapy to me, in addition to the actual therapy. So, so go through it. I remember a few years ago hoping that this was our lottery ticket out of the hard things of running a small business. And
yeah,
it's not, you know, like it's unless something amazing happens with this book.
It could be though.
but it didn't keep me from having to make hard decisions this year. Right. And you know what? And now I'm grateful for it. Because now if anything ever does happen with the book, I've got the experience of making hard decisions in business. So then I can decide between Apple and Netflix and Amazon and Paramount and whoever else wants to come sniffing around. And I hope they all do. I love that. But
yes.
But having to make hard decisions on a much smaller level would hopefully prepare me more for making tough decisions with some success.
Okay, thanks so much for listening to a Growing a Fruitful Brand podcast. This conversation, there's more to share, and so we're actually splitting this up into two episodes. Stay tuned next time for the rest of the conversation, where we get into more about Raj's personal brand and some of the stuff behind that. So stick around for next time.